Welcome to The Clappers. This is Andrew Young.
And this is Carl Quinn.
On this episode of The Clappers, Bad Blood by John Carreyrou.
Fires on the ABC.
Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood and Commander in Chief by Rick Riley.
And brand new Cherry Flavour on Netflix.
Carl, I noticed on social media something completely uncontroversial. You've bought a new coffee machine.
Oh, goodness me, yes. Yes,
It's a thing of antique beauty. It reminded me, I have to say, straight away of one of John Harrison's marine chronometers. Are you familiar with the work of John Harrison's H1, H2?
No,
you haven't read Darvis O'Bell's book, Longitude, then?
No.
All right, well, people can... I might put a picture of one of his beautiful early chronometers. This is, of course, to enable ships at sea to know where they are based on the time at one place and the time where they actually are. So you set your chronometer to the meridian, and then you adjust as you move out, and you see the difference, and it can tell you where you are.
It has exactly the same function, because... I see it there. It's in the kitchen. I know where I am. Mm-hmm. I go and make a coffee. It's morning. I know what time it is. So it has exactly the same function. It's incredible.
It does.
Yeah.
Tell me, does it taste as well as it looks?
Well, I haven't licked the machine, so no. I can't really tell you how it tastes. But the coffee it produces does taste pretty good.
Every new household appliance, I give it a lick.
Well, this...
Yeah. Okay. I call it the lockdown lick.
Yeah,
we've been buying a lot of appliances in lockdown. Yeah, people. I speak about the populace, not
well,
just... Well,
I've got to say, this is the first major purchase, I think, in the 18 months of lockdown. And, mm-hmm. and it came about... I'll just set it up. It is an ECM, mm-hmm. which is... can you guess what ECM stands for?
Electronic counter music.
So close, and yet it stands for espresso coffee machines, which is
fantastic.
Not the most imaginative, title.
I know quite a few companies that make coffee machines. I've never heard of ECM.
I had never come across ECM before, but anyway, I certainly have now. They're made in Heidelberg in Germany.
Okay.
And,
good start.
This thing is called a Mechanica Slim, and it is...
I hate to see the Mechanica fat.
It's a chunky bugger. an excited robot. Anyway, this thing is—it's a thing of beauty. It only came about because I've had this. I don't know if you followed my saga on Facebook a couple of years ago.
I did.
Yeah.
Too boring to re-relate. But you basically tried to fix your own coffee machine.
Yeah,
I had a
Sunbeam Cafe Series EM6910, which I'd have for, I don't know, 12 years or something like that. Mm. And a couple of years ago, it stopped working, and I managed to, through copious reading down rabbit holes of coffee snobs and various forums, found what I thought might be the issues, and I bought parts online, and anyway, I got it working, so I got another 2 years out of it, right? But then it carked it again recently, and I was pretty sure it was a thermostat issue. I had another machine that somebody had given me for spares, and I stripped out the thermostat, put it in, turned it on, seemed to be heating up, and then the power in the house went out. And I thought, I think maybe the time has come. Either I'm going to blow the house up, or I'm going to short circuit myself, or,
I read about the southeastern blackout that we had here in Melbourne
for a few days.
It was you and your coffee machine.
Yep. Anyway, so it was like, okay, well, I'll have a look. And I was ferreting around at various machines and the same sort of price range. And then, of course, the world of coffee machines, there are some very, very beautiful pieces of kit out there. And of course, some very, very not so beautiful prices. And my wife just said, look, buy something beautiful, because it's going to be on the counter for forever. And we're going to look at it for years and years and years and years. So, and we drink coffee every day. And
yeah, we do.
Yeah, da, da, da. Yeah. And she basically gave me permission to be a little bit indulgent. And
extravagant.
And I'm so glad she did. It is a thing of beauty. And as I remarked in posting a photo of this, it was like, you know, the Sunbeam had been a very good, reliable machine, except when it wasn't, and I had to do lots of bodgy repairs over the years.
But 12 years, a lot of people would say 12 years that you've gotten two lives.
Maybe. But as I posted, it was like stepping out of a Corolla and into a Ferrari. It's like, it is a seriously nice piece of kit, and it feels like you're working in a cafe. It's like everything's heavy and bulky.
Sensual experience. Yeah, tactile, as well as olfactory, as well as...
And I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit this, but at night time, I start thinking about the coffee making in the morning.
Do you do what I did? I bought a brand new car over 20 years ago, the first time I'd ever bought a brand new car, and I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it, driving it home. And the night, I bought it in the afternoon, drive it, park it out the front of the house. That night at about 1 a.m, I get up, put on my dressing gown, put on my slippers, go out the front of the house. There it is, parked under a street lamp. One of those amber lamps, just looking beautiful and sleek and glorious. And I'm just standing there looking at it thinking, man, what a great choice you've made. That's a beautiful piece of equipment. And just as I was thinking about my beautiful piece of equipment, a police car pulls up and they wind down the window and the policeman go, hey, sir, because apparently a man standing at 1 or 2 a.m. in his pajamas, dressing gown and slippers on the street in Fitzroy is not a regular occurrence for the police.
Is there a residential care facility nearby that you might have escaped from?
There you are. So they asked me what I was doing, and it sounded absurd as I was telling them. I thought, this doesn't sound right, does it? And so I had to go inside and provide proof of my ownership and residence, and they reluctantly found nothing to arrest me for and let me go back inside.
Well, thankfully, the police have not caught me creeping around the house at 3 a.m.
with a torch in your mouth, fondling.
Stealing a crafty look at the coffee machine.
Buff it with some – you've got some stainless steel cleaner and a cloth.
I wouldn't use stainless steel cleaner. And it's a polished stainless steel thing, so no, it's just like a little wipe. But I've got to say, in terms of licking the appliance, I'm not going to be doing that.
I bet you are.
No, I'm not.
I bet that when we finish this podcast, the first thing you're going to do is check if you've got the place to yourself and give it a good old lick.
Well, it might be the last thing I do, because you leave the machine on the whole time, right?
Oh,
because
do you?
It takes about 20 minutes for the boiler to heat up in the morning if you were to turn it off overnight, right? So you'd have to sort of like set the alarm for 20 minutes before you want your coffee, which I'm not used to doing. And the machine's kind of hot, so...
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So I would not be licking it. Yeah.
Let us remember to put a picture of Harrison's chronometer, not the eventual one, which just looks like a lovely pocket watch, but the earlier one with the gimbals and the armatures.
And I will put a picture of the said coffee machine, which I have to say, one daughter welcomed and said, it's very beautiful. And the other daughter said, it looks like an ugly robot.
There you are, you see.
It's all in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, and I'll post a picture of mine, okay, because mine is the complete opposite of yours. It is a thing of utilitarian Bauhaus beauty that, if you find beauty in that, that I can turn on and it's ready within.
I'm going to guess you've got an Atomic.
No. Oh, you know, my friend up the road had one of those when I was a kid growing up, and his dad made us a coffee in it, and it was like nothing I'd ever tasted. And I've been drinking coffee since I was five. And
have you? Since you were five?
Yeah.
It explains so much.
Instant. Like, right. I didn't start on the hard stuff till I was about 14. but no, I loved them, but they were relentlessly overpriced, and then they made copies of them, and then prices just went all out of whack.
Actually, there's an Australian-made one that is, I mean, it looks almost exactly the same as an Atomic, but it's it comes with a sort of an induction plate. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen this. But anyway, it looks very handsome. It's won all sorts of design awards.
Oh, they are handsome.
I don't know how you can get a design award for ripping off a 50-year-old or an 80-year-old design, you know?
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah. That brings us onto the subject of one of the topics I want to talk about today, and patents, and how you can, whether you should be able to have a patent for something that you didn't invent, that you just made a small adjustment to.
Ooh.
I was reading a book I've just finished, and you'll be interested in this book, if not in itself as a book. It came from an article by a journalist called John Carreyrou, but you may be interested in the upcoming cinema and television adaptations of this book. The book's called Bad Blood. It started out as an article in the Wall Street Journal, and it's about a company called Theranos and a woman called Elizabeth Holmes. Are you aware of this?
No, no. None of it's ringing a bell so far.
Okay, so she is a Stanford dropout who managed to get an extraordinary amount of seed capital to start a company that promised much, delivered little. And the promise was that with just one prick of the thumb, a whole suite of very complex blood analyses can be performed so that you can, in minutes, find out various different types of blood-borne illnesses, diseases, cholesterol.
This is now starting to vaguely ring a bell. Yeah.
The book's called Bad Blood. Yeah. There's been a podcast on it, there's been a documentary on it, and there's going to be a film with, well, the film is mooted with Jennifer Lawrence as Elizabeth Holmes, and a TV series with Amanda Seyfried as Elizabeth Holmes. It's a fascinating story.
So a movie and a TV series.
Yeah.
Right. That's not overkill, perhaps?
Well, I imagine they're going to come out at different... You know, sometimes, like that film, there was a film set... Alexander the Great, I think that the two of them came out at the same time by accident. And sometimes that's just how it works. But anyway, this book is about fraud, ostensibly, about convincing people to invest in something that doesn't exist and somehow avoiding all the regulatory mechanisms and actually using real-life people who are being tested with a machine that didn't work and then it being tested on a regular machine back at the home base in Palo Alto in the Silicon Valley of California. And it's an astonishing story. It like all things that start with a investigative journalism, it becomes a mystery, a whodunit. It becomes a thriller. And it's amazing, you know, the board of this company, Theranos, had people like Henry Kissinger, George Shultz on it, and Elizabeth Holmes was somehow able to find her way in all the corridors of power and managed to convince everybody of the veracity and the validity, even though there was no proof and there was a massive turnover of staff as more and more people became ethically compromised and unable to reconcile what they were doing, which was immoral and illegal. And the journalist John Carreyrou, his investigations led to various trials for antitrust and fraud. The trial has just begun now for the two main people involved, Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani, who was her secret lover and also like the CFO or the CEO of the firm with her. But it's a fascinating story. Quick read. I recommend it. John Carreyrou, and the book is called Bad Blood. But keep your eyes open for the podcast.
Well, I have found the podcast, and there was a documentary released in 2019 directed by Alex Gibney, who is a very well-known documentary maker, called The Inventor, out for blood in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
So I might hunt that down and have a look at that.
Have a look at that.
And the Jennifer Lawrence film was supposed to be out in last year, but I don't know that that's ever surfaced. So
I don't know if it's even been made because of COVID. You know, a lot of things were put on the back burner, or the very expensive, sleek and beautiful looking burner that sits turned on all day and all night on your countertop
on there. On the induction cooktop.
It does sound like you've just set a fire and you've just left that fire going day and night in your house. Anytime someone wants to light a cigarette, they just lean in. So convenient.
It's like having an aga.
Oh, man, don't get me started on them. I have much to say on that topic, which I will leave for another podcast.
Do you know the name Lou Burke?
He's a producer. Wins Oscars and shit.
He wants to meet with me. So you liked my movie?
Truth is, I've been looking to take more chances. Maybe you're the chance I've been looking to take.
You said you could hurt someone for me.
What did he do to you?
This world is predators and prey.
He took the only thing I care about.
Say what you want. I want to set his life on fire.
I want to mention a show, brand new cherry flavor. I got an email from an actress, an Australian actress, a woman called Hannah Levine, and she contacted me and said, hey, I'm in this show. You might want to have a look at it. It's really interesting. Do you want to do a story on me? And which is not something that happens all that often.
Can I just, before we go on? I often get emails like that from publicists for my radio program saying, so-and-so is just putting out this and they've got a tour coming up. Of course, there are no tours coming up at the moment, but would you like to do a feature on them and interview them? And it's an interesting approach.
Well, normally, you know, the publicists are employed to do that, right?
The fact that
an actor contacted me directly was like really odd, I thought. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has happened before. It's not like completely out of the blue. But the fact that it was a Netflix show and I knew nothing about it, right? And it was sort of like falling on an actor to actually reach out about it. It was kind of like, what? That's a bit strange, right? Yeah. So anyway, I sort of forgot about it and then went, oh, yeah, what about that? And went and had a look at it and was just blown away, right? This mm-hmm. show is set in early 90s. Hollywood. It's about a young writer director. Like, she's basically made a student film. Her name's Lisa Nova. She's played by a woman called Rosa Salazar, and Rosa Salazar is fantastic in this show. She was just absolutely magnetic. The first shot is of a little cat wandering across the highway. The second shot is basically yellow lines down the middle of the highway. It brings to mind, for those who are so inclined, David Lynch, right?
Yep.
The sort of aesthetic and the vibe and the tone of David Lynch absolutely suffuses this program, right? So it's 8 episodes, and that little Lost Highway kind of moment, which, you know, if you haven't seen the film, it'll mean nothing to you. But if you have seen Lost Highway, it will immediately, I think, trigger a memory of that. You kind of go, what sort of territory are we in here? And she's on her way to LA. She makes a phone call, stops in a phone booth, makes a phone call to an old friend to say, I'm coming to town. This producer has reached out to me. He wants a meeting. She meets this producer, a guy called Lou Burke, played by Eric Lang. And he is kind of like everything you expect a producer to be, a little bit kind of sleazy, fast talking, very like, I love your work. I want to make a feature out of it. I want you to direct it. You know, it's like the big sales pitch. You go, yeah, so much, you know, bullshit. But then he writes a check for her on the spot in the diner, gives her a $10,000 check to say, look, I'm serious. Okay. And go, well, maybe this is a story about a dream come true, right? I mean, she doesn't have to sleep in a car tonight. Great.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's good. This is a nice story. And then, of course, everything goes off the rails. He sort of makes a move on her, you know, does a bit of a Harvey, grabs her on the thigh. And she says, actually, no, I'm not interested in that. And then he decides to cut her out, right? He's going to give the film to somebody else to direct. She's at an art gallery opening, and she meets this woman played by Catherine Keener. And, you know, anybody who knows Catherine Keener is going to immediately be a little bit excited by the fact that she's in this. She basically schools her in how to imagine herself into his house, imagining him as a house. She's inside, and she says, now break something. And suddenly he's got a blood nose. Now, is that coincidence, or has she actually managed to
somehow? This is like a supernatural horror.
It has a supernatural horror kind of element. Yeah, it has body horror element. I mean, this woman played by Catherine Keener, she's called Borrow. It turns out to be an ancient South American witch, and who jumps from body to body to, you know, prolong her existence. And she extracts payment from Lisa in the form of kittens, which Lisa has to spew up from her mouth. And it just gets more and more oddball as it goes, and it's very dark. There are a couple of moments where it almost goes completely off the rails, where it just becomes so silly that it's like, oh, this is, you know, this is terrible. But it doesn't. It never goes there. It just teeters right on the edge. So it's got this kind of Lynchian sort of other dimension, sort of, you know, lots of delving into the sort of subconscious and the sort of surreal kind of elements. Then it's got this really sort of David Cronenberg kind of flavored body horror. And it is just It's great. It's basically an L.A. noir kind of story with these kind of supernatural, surrealist and body horror elements, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. I think it's just such a piece of fun, absolutely unexpected, out of the box. I've probably ruined it for everybody, and it can't be as unexpected to anybody who's heard this as it was to me, but it's really, really worth having a look at.
And that's why I don't...
you don't listen to this show.
I don't read stuff. If I'm going to see something, I'm not going to read anything about it.
Well, this
I'm
is gonna, the kind of deal with it. The devil you make, isn't it, a little bit? Because, you know, people would not have found this show. It was not promoted. It was not...
Yeah.
It's not turned up on your top 10 in Australia today. It's not, like, recommended. It's not one of those shows that crops up anywhere. It's just dropped, right? It's just dropped onto Netflix, and the vast majority of people will not have seen it or heard of it or had a look at it. And I've had a couple of people reach out to me after I reviewed this saying, oh, my God, thank you so much for pointing me to that show. It's incredible, right?
Did you get back in touch with the actress?
I emailed her to say, look, I'm sorry I wasn't able to mention you in the review, but, you know, she was delighted that I'd written about it anyway. So, yeah.
Oh, good stuff.
Hmm. So thank you, Hannah Levine, for pointing it out to me.
Thank you, Hannah Levine, for everybody who gets the chance to watch your show. And I hope you get another one. Two books I want to briefly recommend to people. One is called Commander in Cheat by Rick Riley. He's a sports journalist for Sports Illustrated. Apparently his back page is the most popular back page of Sports Illustrated. And he decided to write a book about golf in as much as it relates to the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, and what a cheat he is. I don't play golf. I don't watch golf. But this book is hilarious in positing the great man in the great sport and how much he does to ruin it and destroy it for everybody. And it's just so funny. He is a relentless and unapologetic cheat. It's astonishing reading about how he cheats during the game of golf. And this man, Rick Riley, is a golfer himself and has played golf all his life. And he's furious at the fact that a game that has only, he felt, recently come back from being thought the preserve of idle millionaires and plutocrats and was actually seen for what it is, with guys like, you know, Tiger Woods and Tom Watson, people who did not grow up under a lot of wealth and privilege. Trump has now turned it back into a game like that. And it's very funny reading about how the people of Scotland react when he decides to turn up there, and about the kind of ugly course designs that he makes his course architects do, with massive waterfalls and gold statues of dolphins. And it is so funny. Just read the first page, which you can, I see on Google Books or something, you can just have a look at the very first page where Trump thrusts out a fat hand with tiny fingers to shake Rick Riley's hand at a celebrity tournament, and then insists on meeting him, and then Rick Riley talking about how he gets there and the first thing Trump does is pull out a card from his drawers and boast that he's one of only five people to have these, including Mother Teresa, and that card is a gold McDonald's card that gives you free McDonald's at any McDonald's anywhere in the world. Donald Trump, Mother Teresa, and just three other people have this.
And Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa, who is deceased now,
of course. She made heavy use of it.
Well, she would have. I'll have 5,000 Happy Meals, Happy Meals.
Just deliver them to the slums in Calcutta.
P.G. Woodhouse says, if you want to know anything about a man, watch how he plays golf, you know. And he talks about the other presidents and how they play and their attitude to the game and their skill or otherwise. Like I say, I'm not a golfer. I don't watch the golf. I have to confess, I once went to a driving range and was astonished.
You were disappointed. How am I supposed to get my car in here, you said.
I was shocked at how I was unable to hit a ball with a club forward. Yeah. I could hit it so it ricocheted backwards and forwards around my head in the cage, but to actually get it out of that space, which is probably 2 metres, 2.5 metres.
It's harder than it looks, isn't it?
It was mental. Yeah. I was so embarrassed. I couldn't believe my lack of skill, and I've never hefted a club since. So this is not for the golfers. It is for the golfers because my dad's a golfer and he read it in one sitting. But it's for everybody, this book. It is great and hilarious. It's called Commander in Cheat by Rick Reiling.
The title alone has got me almost over the line.
No, I think you'll love it. And I think you might also love Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood, who at the moment is reclining on the shortlist of the Booker for her most recent tome. This Priest Daddy is funny, very funny, because she's a grown woman who returns home with her husband to live with her parents. But her dad is a Catholic priest, which as a former Catholic yourself, you'll think is a little odd. But apparently, if you're a minister of another order and you decide to leave that order and convert to Catholicism, you get a special dispensation, in his case, from Ratzinger. You're allowed to become a priest.
So you don't have to become celibate in retrospect.
No, you don't have to divorce your wife. Yeah, you are allowed to keep your wife, keep your kids, and be a priest. And it is another hilarious book. Her dad is a priest, but he also collects firearms and electric guitars and is an arch right-wing Republican. And it's just
a delight.
You think that's a little bit of ingratitude that Patricia Lockwood moves home with her husband because he's had a terrible disease in his eyes and has had to have surgery and can't work. And because she's a poet, he's been supporting her with his journalism. And so they both have to go home to the rectory or whatever you call the house, the manse that the priest lives in. And she basically just makes fun of them. It's very funny. It's a very funny look at contemporary American society, at Trump's society, and at the Catholic Church. It gets, as you would expect, it gets dark in a couple of places for sure, as anything to do with the priesthood would. But it's a very, very funny book. Her columns in the London Review of Books, I always read and often read aloud because they're just so funny. And it's definitely something to keep an eye out for. You don't have to be Roman Catholic. You don't have to be lapsed Roman Catholic. You don't have to have any beliefs whatsoever to read and enjoy this book. I say that on the Sabbath, by the way. So Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood is another recommendation for the listener.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you aware there's a leave now fire order in place for Woolies Bay?
Yeah. We're staying to defend. My partner's on his way back from Canberra, so he should be here soon.
You only have one access right into your property. If you get into trouble, we'll be able to get to you.
We have a fire plan, and we've been preparing in line with the CFS recommendations.
Well, you should monitor your radio. If you hear the shelter-in-place warning, that means the fire's close. You won't be able to leave by that point.
And don't get into your car. You won't be safe in your car.
I know that. I know what to do.
You say you know what to do, but you have no idea what it's like. The fire will hit, then it will turn pitch black. You won't be able to see anything. You won't be able to breathe because of the smoke and the noise. It's like a freight train going right over the top of you.
Can we get your full name and your partner's, please?
What for?
In case the coroner needs it.
Andrew. Have you watched Fires at all on the ABC?
I've not watched Fires on the ABC.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
I do. It's a series about the bushfires here in Victoria, is it?
Well, it's about the bushfires nationally in 2019-20.
Okay.
It starts in Queensland in, I think, September, I think it is, which, you know, is in very itself a remarkable that there were bushfires of any kind of, you know, scale there at that early in the season. Then moves, you know, the second episode, I think, is November, and then it keeps going, basically, over the course of the summer. There are six episodes. I've only seen the first three, so I don't know if it sustains it over the course of the six, but on the basis of the three I've seen, it's a remarkable show. It's very hard. It's very hard to watch. But the second episode in particular is just, I think, breathtakingly good and breathtakingly sad. It stars Richard Roxburgh and Miranda Otto as a married couple of farmers. Whose property is destroyed. And so you basically meet them the morning after, well, the day after they go to the property to see what state it's in, and they basically look at the ruins of their house, and, you know, they've lost a lot of cattle. They're out there having to put them down, the injured ones, and, you know, they've got a few that have survived and a shed that survived so they can carry on producing a bit of milk and blah, blah, blah. And it's just about them dealing with this sort of, like, you know, what's left. Roxburgh, as the husband, says it's only stuff, it doesn't matter. And then Miranda Otto says it's not only stuff, you know, because it's actually, these are the artifacts of a life, you know, kind of thing. So it really captures that, the trauma and how how you assess it and how you sort of balance the thank goodness we survived with the but what have we lost kind of thing. And then they're dealing with, you know, a son who's missing, and is he alive, is he not alive? And they're dealing with his partner who is a city girl who's living on another another house on the property, and there's a bit of tension there. And they're dealing with the media, you know, who are sort of in there trying to sort of say, well, what's happened? You know, let's talk, tell us your story so the world knows, you know, which is, you know, it's, again, it's a sort of the deal with the devil that you make. It's like, do I want my privacy, or do I want people to understand what this experience is like? And, you know, there's all that stuff captured in it. And I think it's an absolutely remarkable piece of TV. I think one of the best hours of Australian drama I've ever seen. The three episodes I've seen are all good. They all take a different perspective. The first one starts with two young firefighters who get caught in a burnover. The third one deals with a couple played by Dan Spielman and Anna Torv, who are both terrific actors, who have made the deal that they're going to stay and fight and save their house. And then, you know, things conspire to make that more and more problematic. And then ultimately they're just faced with the enormity of what that decision really means when the firefront begins to advance. It's like, it is intense stuff, really, really well made, and really, really moving, and takes you deep into this stuff that, you know, for those of us who live in cities, yeah. I mean, my experience of that summer was one in which, you know, camping holidays couldn't happen. You know, we were dealing with the pall of smoke and how difficult it was to breathe in the cities, the orange skies. Of course, it was on the news everywhere. It was like, you know, you're not unaware of it.
No.
But what it actually feels like to be in that space when you come face to face with that. I think for most of us, we can kind of get a sense of it, kind of imagine it, kind of appreciate it, but it's a bit abstract. And I think the power of something like this is it just makes it much more felt. And I, for that reason, I think it's really great. But my word, it's really hard. And I think anybody who did find themselves in that situation where they had to deal with it directly, I don't think they could even begin to watch this stuff because it is so triggering. And I did, in writing about this, I asked the question, you know, is it too soon? And the comments were like running about 8-2. Yes, it's too soon. I cannot watch this, which is really interesting. And the, you know, the ratings for this have not been fantastic so far. And
usually the phrase too soon implies offence. With comedy, it's often, is it too soon to make jokes about this event or that event?
Yeah, sure, it does that, but it also goes beyond that. I mean, it's simply a question of is it too soon to put this out there as something to ask us to engage with, you know? And that's what the question is here. Is it too soon to turn this into entertainment, right?
Yeah, you know? So is it too soon for this to be entertainment rather than a documentary?
Yeah, and I think the notion of entertainment, as if it only serves one function, or if it only lives in one space, is a bit reductive. It's not like watching Midsummer Murders, let's say, on a Sunday night. You know, it's not like watching, it's not even like watching The Newsreader, which was the Australian series that was on before it and which did get a very, very big audience, was very successful. Yeah. It's a very different ask. I think it's absolutely worthwhile. I don't know that I would say to people, you must watch it, but I would say that if you've got the stomach for it, there's a lot to be gained by watching it, I think, in terms of understanding just what it must have felt like for those people. And I think that anybody who's on the fence about, is anybody on the fence still, other than the people who run this country, about, you know, the seriousness of climate change and the kind of environmental catastrophe
Taylor,
that lurks?
I think Angus Taylor is Barnaby Joyce.
Yeah, so there's one or two. So maybe they should be strapped into a chair, you know, Clockwork Orange style, and forced to watch it without blinking. But the rest of us, you know, I think the choices here to be made.
Thank you for listening to The Clappers. We'll put a couple of pictures of some really interesting things up on our Facebook page.
Ugly robots and chronometers and all sorts of things.